Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Welcome back to MTG Pro Tutor. This is episode 182. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Sean Penrod, your host, and I'm so happy that you are here with us. Man, there has been a lot of cool stuff going on in Magic. Last weekend, we had two Grand Prix, one in Barcelona, one in New Jersey. And like I say all the time, I love seeing past guests go on and do great things. But holy cow, Marcio Carvalho, amazing. Another Grand Prix top eight. He's just killing it this year. Congrats to him. Past guests, you can just go a few episodes ago, check out his show. And then I also love seeing new faces in the top eight of Grand Prix because it means new people that we can reach out to, bring on the show, and get to know their stories. Here at MTG Pro Tutor, we do two episodes each and every week of the best players in the world. Grand Prix top eights, Pro Tour top 16s, Magic Online Championship players, World Magic Cup participants, and of course we splash in community icons to give us a well-rounded view of what's going on in the Magic community. So, I'm glad that you're here. If you're looking to improve your Magic game, you are in the right spot. The goal of MTG Pro Tutor is to help 1,000 players qualify for the Pro Tour, and I'm really looking forward to helping you be one of those. To meet that goal, we have the podcast here, where, like I mentioned, we bring on the best players, so you can really hear what they're going through, what they've been through, relate with them on multiple levels, and get inspiration on how you can improve your game. In addition to the podcast, there are other offerings that I'm putting together to help you level up your game and really take Magic seriously. I have a Magic course called Level Up Your Magic the Gathering Skills, where past guests, including a Hall of Famer, have contributed lessons to help you really understand the mindset and the skill sets necessary to succeed in Magic. I also have a deck building masterclass coming up where I'm recording really deep discussions with some of the best deck builders to really understand what it takes to understand the meta, evaluate what's going on, and figure out the way to move forward. So it's an exciting time to be a Magic player. I love this. Absolutely love this. And I'm so happy that you're here on this journey with me. Before we dive into the interview today, I do want to give a huge thank you to the patrons. I love you guys. Thank you so much for supporting the show. It really means the world to me. Because of you, I'm able to do things like hire out the show notes and hire out the editing. Two things that I'm not good at that need to be done. And because of the generosity of the patrons, those two aspects of the show are covered. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If you like what you hear and you are interested in supporting the show directly, you can go to mtgprotutor.com/Patreon to learn more about that. Basically, you can pledge any amount you want per episode and then set a monthly limit so you never go out of budget. And it goes a long way to helping the show stay up and running. So thank you, thank you, thank you. As a give back, I love doing a drawing each and every month for the patrons where one lucky contributor will get a bundle of the current Magic set. Well, that's it for Magic news and upfront acknowledgements. So without further ado, let's bring in our guest, sit down and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I am super excited to have our guest with us today. Our guest is a full-time project manager who plays Magic in the little spare time he can muster. He was introduced to the game back in 1998 and has played competitively, off and on, since about 2012. He top 25 Pro Tour Journey into Nyx, top 8ed Grand Prix Pittsburgh in 2017, and won SCG Philadelphia in 2013. Coming to us from Syracuse, New York, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, Adam Von Fleet. Adam, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Sean. How are you?
Fantastic. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take the game to the next level?
Sure, absolutely.
Excellent. Now, prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Adam, say thanks for being on the show, ask him a question. He's actually not on Twitter, so the best place to find him will be in the Facebook group, the Prodigy Facebook group. So if you're not a part of that yet, go ahead and request to join. We'll get you in there, and you can message him and say, hey, thanks for being on the show, or you know, ask him whatever you want. So that's how you can find him. So, Adam, are you born and raised in Syracuse, New York? Is that your homestead?
Pretty close by. I was born about an hour and a half away, but went to school in Rochester, New York, and found a job in Syracuse, New York. So pretty much upstate New York my whole life.
Excellent, excellent. And what did you go to school for?
Electrical engineering.
Okay, excellent. And then is that what you're doing with the project manager thing? So you are project manager for an electrical engineering type of company?
Yeah, we design radar subsystems for companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing. They subcontract to us.
Excellent.
So I manage those types of programs.
That's awesome. So are you considered a government contractor?
We are a subcontractor to government contracts.
To government contracts. Excellent. That sounds awesome. My dad has worked for Lockheed Martin for many, many years. So, and then
I just finished up an active duty tour in the Navy, so know a little bit about government contracts and whatnot, at least from my dad's exposure, and then didn't have too much experience with it when I was on the inside, but I do know a little bit about that world. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, it keeps you busy, and like you said, the little spare time you have, you spend it on magic.
Yeah, and some other things, but yeah, magic is one of many.
Excellent. Now, do you have siblings that you grew up playing with, especially back in 1998, or are you kind of a lone wolf in your family?
Yeah, well, actually, my brother played a little with me, not too much, and our neighbors played. But back when we played in the 90s, we were teenagers, so we were like, we had like infinite mana, and Masticore just instantly won you the game, kind of playing Magic. We didn't really know what we were doing.
Yeah, love it. Oh, I love those old school stories. My favorite one is foil lands with tap for 2 mana and stuff like that.
I thought Jester's Cap was like the best card in the world. Because I'm like, what? I get to look to your deck. This is great.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it. So that's a perfect segue into your origin story. Every hero has their beginning somewhere. And so we would love to hear, when was the very first time you ever saw or play with Magic cards? Take us there. We want to smell them over your shoulder. What was that like?
Let's see. I was probably 14 years old. And my dad brought me to a game store, and I got a starter set of, I think it was Exodus. I think that was the first set that my dad got me. Yeah, I think it was like a starter of Exodus, whichever one had the flying fish with phasing. If you remember that ability, that was a long time ago.
I do remember phasing. That was a long time ago. My intro to Magic was back then, too. I clearly remember Weatherlight, Stronghold, Tempest, that whole storyline. I remember that very, very, very clearly. I didn't, don't have anything cool from back then, but, fell out for many years like many people do. But, I do remember phasing that mechanic. Yeah.
And the books are actually what I liked, the little books better than I liked the card game back then.
I always tell people that, like, I loved the story, like the mini comic almost that was inside the rule book that, it's just, the size of a Magic card, but it had many, many pages you can go through and see the story. I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are, those as well as the, there was, Borders style books that you could buy that were maybe 300 pages, little stories about, I think the ones from the Onslaught series was about like Ixidor and stuff. Those are really good to read.
Oh, nice.
If you're growing up young playing Magic.
Yeah. So why did your dad take you to a game store? Is gaming in your family?
No, actually, my dad doesn't play games at all. We were just walking by one in Rochester and stopped by to check it out, and I thought the fish looked cool, and it was like $8, so he bought it for me.
That's awesome.
And then we played with Infinite Mana and had no idea what we were doing, but it was fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. That is really, really cool. So since then, what has been your favorite set?
Oh, geez. I would probably say the Mirrodin was the set that got me to enjoy competitive Magic and probably killed a lot of people's interest in competitive Magic. But I really liked playing Ravager Affinity during the Mirrodin Darksteel sets. But the one I probably liked the most was probably Theros Block.
Oh, sweet.
And which is probably odd for a lot of people, but for some reason, drafting it came very natural to me. It seemed really, really easy and intuitive for me to understand what my side drafters were picking, and I didn't have to overthink anything. I could easily build decks. I think I went 4-0 in maybe like 30 consecutive online tournaments drafting Theros, so, or 3-0, I'm sorry, 3-0 in the drafts.
Yeah.
When I was preparing for Pro Tour, whatever the second set was there.
Journey
was the
second one.
Yeah, Journey, yeah. The one in top 25.
Yeah, that one.
When I was preparing for that, I drafted a lot of it. Wow. It was really good.
Why is that, do you think? That's very fascinating that, that particular set clicked with you. Why do you think that is? Like, have you been able to pinpoint?
I think it was because if the power level of the gold cards, like, for example, the black-green guy that was like a 4-3 that returned a card from your graveyard to your hand, they were so strong, but because there was so little mana fixing, people were really trying to stick to, like, the red-white aggro shell really hard and push it. Or they were really afraid to go into these four color decks where you would get the enchantment that allows your land to tap for a mana of any color and drew you a card and things of that nature. And so you could build 3 and 4 color decks with really powerful gold cards and people didn't seem to value them very highly. So maybe it was just, I like to read Reed Duke's articles, and when he was writing for Star City at the time, I think. Now he's on Channel Fireball, but he tends to know a lot about the limited format. Obviously, he's putting a lot of time into it, and he talked about these 3 and 4 color decks with the black green base. And then I started drafting. I was like, this makes a lot of sense. Nobody else is taking these cards. They're really good.
Huh.
Draft good cards.
So have you been able to carry over any of that to, you know, future sets?
I've done pretty well in limited for the most part. I do very, very well in sealed decks just because I think I have a reasonable ability to evaluate cards when I'm seeing them for the first time. But as far as Pro Tour drafts go, I think I went 4-2 in my first Pro Tour draft. I went 6-0 in the second one, and I went 3-3 in the third. So far, I'm not doing terribly great. I did well in one of them. But yeah, I like to draft. I like limited. I think it's my favorite format. Unfortunately, I hate the risk-reward nature of going to any kind of major event for it. You know, you drive to a GP, you pay $50 to $100 for an entry fee, right, and then hotel and gas. And then you open up just absolute garbage, and you wish you never came.
Yeah, that is, yeah, sealed is definitely, you know, a two-edged sword on that regard, because the other side is everybody has, you know, the same chance as you of getting a good pool or not, and you don't have to worry about coming with the right deck and all that stuff. So very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. If you consider yourself an average player or an above average player, not great but above average, then I think that sealed GPs are really the way to go, because you have that ability to just open a pool that's inherently much more powerful than what other people are going to be opening. And if you can pilot it fairly well, you'll probably do well at the GP.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, I love it. So that was a really good rabbit hole we went down. But back to favorites, I wanted to ask you, what is one of, because I know there's thousands, but one of your favorite cards?
Well, I really like Darkbound Ravager again. So that one was a good one, but it was really good in its format. It's not necessarily the greatest card on its own. So as a standalone card, I'd probably say Force of Will.
Oh, excellent. So for those of us who don't know, what is Force of Will? What does it do? And why do you like it?
Force of Will is a counter spell that costs 5 mana, 3 and 2 blue. You can, as an alternate cost, exile another blue card from your hand and lose one life. And the spell counters a spell. So it's a very, I'll say, unfair, fair magic card from the standpoint of all it does is 1-for-1, well, excuse me, 2-for-1, yourself for your opponent's spell. But it's a really good crutch in Legacy. I don't play any Vintage, but in Legacy, at least, it's nice to not just die on turn one because you didn't draw like a Thoughtseize or something like that to your opponent's Storm deck. So.
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. What? So do you have your own play set of Force of Wills?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Do you have the old ones or the new ones?
The old ones.
Awesome. Of course. Very cool. Very cool. So what makes Magic fun for you, Adam? Why do you play? Obviously, you mentioned you have other things going on in your life, but you've been playing since 98. So why? What is it about it that keeps you in?
Well, in the early days when I played, it was just, we didn't know what we were doing. So it was just about doing something, playing any game. We could have been playing Monopoly, but we just played because it was something to do and it was fun. And then as time progressed and I started to understand more about the game and get a little bit better and get a little bit more competitive with it, it was more just the competitive nature of the game that was fun, you know, playing. And I'm talking about semi-competitive, like FNMs and those styles of tournaments. I don't even think FNM existed back then. They had JSS or whatever. But it was fun to play something that I found I was naturally decent at and had fun doing. And I met a lot of cool people in a neighboring town of Oneana, made some really good friends. My best friend really is from there. And it gave me like a group of people to hang out with outside of the high school group of people that we saw every day. I'm from a small town, so we had about 100 kids in our graduating class. So you always saw the same people, and it was fun to travel 15 minutes, if you will, on a regular basis to go see friends. And then I went off to college and stopped playing for most of college, and came back in 2010-ish and started just playing pre-releases is all I really ever played. Just because they were fun. You got to see new cards. You'd get a lot of people to turn out. There might be 50 to 150 people at a pre-release, and see what the new things that Wizards brewed up for abilities and stuff. And then actually my first PTQ I ever won was completely on accident. I didn't play Magic at the time, really. Just decided I wanted to stop by the game store and see what some friends were doing. And I walked in the game store. There was 200 people there. What the heck is going on? And they said, oh, there's a PTQ going on. I said, oh, all right. Well, anybody have something I could play? And my buddy goes, here's a trade binder. You can build something out of it.
What?
And I threw together a I was looking through his trade binder. I found Domri Raid.
Oh, yeah.
I said, this guy looks awesome. I want to build a deck with this guy. I'm like, oh, if you want to build that guy, you need some of these and some of these. And everybody just started giving me commons and uncommons. And I had Aurelius Furies in my sideboard. I don't think I could even cast.
What?
and I ended up winning the PTQ.
Oh, my God.
And I was just like, okay, all right. So that got me to Dublin for Pro Tour Theros.
Oh, my gosh.
And I did reasonable there. I had day two'd, and then I lost my last two rounds to miss any money. But it was exciting and fun, and it was really kind of awe-inspiring to walk into the Dublin Convention Center and just see, you know, John Finkel and Reed Duke and all these people that you'd heard about. Reed is actually new. I think he just won a Mox or something mm-hmm. to get onto the Pro Tour not too long before that. But, you know, Kai Bud wasn't there. Zvi Mauschwitz. You see all these people that you grew up in the 90s and 2000s. Like, these are the great, like, Zvi was like the greatest Magic player next to Kai Bud. And you're seeing these people, and it's pretty cool when you're not used to it, you know? Yeah. And then after I day two'd the first Pro Tour, I said, okay, that was pretty cool. And I went back home and So, you know, I want to try and be competitive and get on another Pro Tour. And I played in, I think I top eighted 5 or 6 consecutive PTQs before I won another one and went to, I think it was either Washington or Atlanta for the next one. And then I said, you know what, I'm going to actually get really serious about this and spent some serious time drafting on Magic Online. And the more I drafted, the more I liked it and the more I had fun. The better I got, the more repetitions I could start to. It almost felt like I was drafting maybe 2 or 3 times a day, nice. Leading up to the Pro Tour, and it got to the point where you could almost see what was in your opponent's hand just by the way they were playing, because you were so used to people doing the same things over and over again.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, that's
you cool. got like a second intuition about what they had, and then I And then obviously when I topped 25 that Pro Tour, I was like, all right, this is, you know, there's something serious here. I can actually do this. And went to a third Pro Tour and then missed silver status by a couple of pro points. And so then they changed the PTQ system from this, you win a PTQ to now you have to win a PTQ and then top 4 another PTQ.
Right, the 2-step process, the PPTQ to the RPTQ.
Right, yeah. And that kind of killed my joy in the competitive scene again, to be honest with you, is, you know, for a guy that works 50 to 60 hours a week and then has, you know, I have a girlfriend to do stuff with and a family and everything, it doesn't leave you with a lot of time to try and drive 2 hours to win a tournament, to go drive 5 other hours to try
win
and win
another
tournament.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of went casual again and just played local pre-releases, and if there was a PTQ or something that was in my hometown of Syracuse or nearby in like Binghamton, then I'd go play that. But for the most part, it was just relaxed. And then my buddies wanted to go to GP Pittsburgh, and I read another Reed Duke article and said, all right, I can play that deck, and why not? Top 8-ed that. So I guess here I am again.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Back on the train.
Yeah, and that got you to which Pro Tour?
That gets me to Nashville.
Nashville,
yep.
Okay.
In May.
Very cool. Wow, that's awesome. And this is, so, yeah, with all the times you've been on the Pro Tour, this is your first Grand Prix top 8?
That, yep, I've had a lot of close calls. I've had a lot of X4s and X31s, but this is my first top eight.
So on that note, what does it take? So if you are consistently making day two of a Grand Prix, what does it take to move up to the top eight? So what did you feel was different? What do you feel helped? You know, I know that there's, you know, a certain element of luck that has to go your way. You know, we've had a past guest talk about that, but, you know, so aside from that, what do you feel it takes to go from consistently being a Grand Prix day two-er to making top eight?
Well, luck is definitely a portion of it. In GP Pittsburgh, I probably played three players playing green-black. I played green-black constrictor. And I probably played three other players with better builds of the deck than mine was, in my opinion, and got a little lucky to pull off some wins. But I think really to do well at GPs, you need to really understand what the metagame is going to be and what are you going to play a lot of, and then position yourself to do really well against those decks and hope to dodge your bad matchups. And I did that pretty well. I played a Delirium style build of the black green constrictor so that I would have a better long game against other black green decks and have Ishkana for the Mardu decks. And prior to the Pro Tour, I was actually raving to a bunch of friends here in Syracuse that Mardu Vehicles was going to be the breakout deck of the Pro Tour. I said, Heart of Kieran is busted. I said, this card is better than Smuggler's Copter. And all my friends said, you're nuts. And I said, you haven't played with this card. It is fantastic. And Mardu Vehicles is going to be the deck to beat. And then, so I was playing Mardu Vehicles in my local tournaments, FNMs and whatnot, and just crushing. And the Pro Tour comes out and six Mardu decks, top eight the Pro Tour. I said, well, I can't play that at the GP now. You know that right after a Pro Tour, everybody's going to play the deck that beats the deck that won the Pro Tour. And the other half of the people are going to play the deck that won the Pro Tour.
Yep.
So that put me back to the drawing board and back on green-black, which was a deck I was tinkering with in the last rotation, but with much better cards now, obviously. And so I said, okay, the metagame's going to be probably 40-45% people on Mardu. And then there's going to be another 40 to 45% people on black green trying to beat Mardu. So I got to beat those two decks and then hope I don't get paired against control. And so that's the way I built my deck. I played the GP. I played Mardu Vehicles, I think, five times. I played black green seven times. And I played control three times. And I got very lucky against the control players. So that's what you got to do, dodge your bad matchups or get lucky against them, I guess.
Now, so in this particular Grand Prix, control wasn't going to be that big of the field because of Mardu Vehicle, right? It's just too fast, and so people who are playing control would probably get punished by the most popular deck that just won the Pro Tour.
Right.
Yeah?
A lot of the people on the Shaheeli control, I think one of my pet peeves about the new age of Magic with how easy it is to just Google the best deck is I feel like maybe 85-90% of the people that go to any major tournament anymore, even FNMs, just go online and look at what, you know, MTG top eight or something and look at what won, and then they just play that. And so there's very little innovation, in my opinion, naturally happening. People aren't looking at cards and understanding if they're good and what they're good against, and then being able to see what the format's doing and then pick those cards to play again. They're just going, oh, well, this guy did well with it at the last GP. I'm going to go play that deck. And it's stifling, I think, for decks. So right now you have pretty much everyone's playing that was playing control was playing this Shaheeli Jeskai list, which is, in my opinion, really bad because even the black-green deck beats it a fair amount of the time. So your best matchup's like a 60% matchup. That's not anything to rave about. But my buddies innovated a blue-red control deck, very similar to the blue-red deck that won the Pro, either won or came in second. I think Jeremy Dazzani played a blue-red control deck not too long ago. Very similar to that. And it was actually, I think in our testing, they were probably in the range of 60 to 70% of beating me on black-green and still beating me on Mardu vehicles at the same percentage. And I think that's what people really need to do, is figure out, how do I beat both of these decks and still play control rather than just pick the net deck?
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's the path of least resistance. You know, like you said, it's so easy just to look it up and then run someone else's list. And so that's a very, very good point. And those who, I feel like those who do go through the effort and take the time to analyze and consider new cards and really innovate, you know, they get a payoff. You know, they're the ones that break out somewhere, and then those are the decks that people start running into later. Yeah, like you said, it's the path of least resistance. People just look it up and do whatever, and or do what everyone else is doing. So very interesting.
Well, what it really boils down to, especially for your audience on this podcast, is do you want to win an event, or do you want to become a better Magic player? And if you want to make yourself a better Magic player, then eventually you're going to win events, because you're just naturally going to get better. So focus on that. Focus on becoming better and understanding what makes cards good, so that when future cards come out, you can easily assess their power level. And then what metagames tend to do, how people react to things happening. You know, if you have a top eight where, let's say, a blue deck wins 3 GPs in a row, but the other 7 decks in the top 8 are other decks, then people are going to stay playing a diverse metagame. They're going to play their, you know, it seems like the field is pretty diverse. They're going to play what they're good, what they feel good at, or what they like. But if you have top 8s where 7 of the top 8 decks are all one deck, well, maybe it's time to build something that beats that. And then you have an edge the next GP. And being able to assess what cards are good in what situations. One of my good buddies is a pretty hardcore Legacy player. He invented a Storm deck for Legacy. And he actually taught me a lot when I started to play Legacy, particularly when teaching me how to develop a sideboard. And he said, when we were looking at it, I was playing Stoneblade at the time or something, and he was trying to explain, he had a bunch of one-ofs in his sideboard. I thought, this is stupid. Why would anyone do this? Why wouldn't you just put 3 of a really good card in your sideboard? And he explained, well, let's look at a card like, you know, Chain of Vapor, you know, which is a 1 blue, for people that don't know, it's a 1 blue instant that bounces a non-land permanent. Maybe it bounces lands. But he goes, you know, this card is it's not as good as something like Abrupt Decay that just destroys the permanent, but it's 1 less mana. And it's more diverse, because you can hit things that are 4 mana, or you can hit things that are 5 mana, you know. So he helped me to understand that you want to evaluate cards for a wide array. Either a card needs to be very widely applicable, or it needs to be very inherently powerful. Something like Blood Moon, where it's, you know, there's a very narrow matchups where that card's going to be good. But when it's good, it's really good. So that kind of growth and development and understanding of the game helps you in the future. So when you're building your own standard deck, you can say, for a good example now with the current standard, is do I play the 1 green destroy target artifact or enchantment with converted mana cost 3 or less? Or do I play the 1 in a green instant that puts an artifact on the bottom of their library? And you say, well, the 1 green one, it destroys enchantments, so it can hit things like Fevered Visions, which is really good if the meta shifts to a blue-red meta. Or the 2 mana version that puts the artifact on the bottom of the library is much better against like Scrap Heap Scrounger, because it doesn't put the card in their graveyard. So as you can learn to assess what makes cards good and more widely applicable, you can pick better cards for your deck and then have a better chance at doing well in these big tournaments.
And how do you go about developing or honing that skill, that knowledge of understanding what cards are good in certain situations?
I think I can't say how everybody learns. The way that I've learned is just by listening to people that know. You know, you find people that really know what they're talking about and can back it up with either a record, you know, people like the pros that write on these websites that have done very, very well for themselves. Typically, if I want to learn about any limited card, I just read an LSV article, because that guy seems to always be right with cards that are really good and limited. And then I take their advice, and then I might read some other people and see what their thoughts are. Or I might talk to friends and see what they think and why they think a card's good. And a lot of the times you can even learn little things by, if you're playing in a tournament even like a local FNM or something, and someone plays a card that's really obscure, and you can just ask them, you know, why do you play that card? And see what they're thinking. They might be, you know, oh, I really wanted it for this situation. You go, oh, I've never actually thought of that before. That's interesting. And you don't have to do it, but you can at least think about it and learn incrementally. One great thing I've seen pros do, I mean, technically, I guess I'm a pro, but, you know, pros that with a lot of accomplishments do is, and you know what is a great story for this is actually the Pro Tour in Washington. I was sitting with a couple of guys watching them play test their deck before the Pro Tour, and Zvi Mauschwitz is just walking around, sitting next to random people that had, it's probably their first Pro Tour, and he's just watching them play and asking them about their decks and asking about what cards they're playing and why they're playing. And I turned to Zvi and I said, Zvi, you're like one of the greatest players in this game. Why are you asking people, you know, that clearly haven't played very long, why they're doing things? Because you can always learn. There's never too late to learn. And so just that kind of takeaway of being willing to listen to what other people are doing, why they're doing it, having think about it for yourself and make those assessments, you start to get better at it. Versus the flip side of that is if you always net deck, you're never going to get better. You might net deck the right deck this tournament. And then what do you do when you go to a Pro Tour and a new set comes out and you have nobody to test with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, Zvi's awesome. He was actually episode 34 on the MTG Pro Tour podcast on this show. And so he was a really cool guest to have on. And, you know, I love what you're talking about net decking versus innovating and whatnot. And I heard a quote, I'm fairly positive it's Patrick Chapin. At least it was attributed to him. No, it was him. But anyway, he said, if you don't net deck, you have no brain. But if you don't brew, you have no heart. And you have to have a balance between the two, because you don't want to completely discount all the work that people have put into finding out what's good, but you also can't just go along 100% with what's going on online, you know, because then you'll always be a week or two behind, and you can't just, you know, copy a sideboard guide and then just assume it's good for you. You know, like those were tuned for that particular event, and you can't just assume it's going to work, you know, for your event. So you definitely need to, like you said, you know, put some thought into it, talk to people, think about it, make your own little changes as to, you know, this card, that card, and you can start with, you know, a shell of somebody else's or whatever, but, you know, you definitely still need to put in your own effort to make it yours. And sometimes you just make up your whole, you know, your own thing completely brand new and make it work from there. So that's really, really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And even when you, if you do net deck, even if you don't, if you do look at other decks online, I should say, at a bare minimum, you get to see what other people are playing and what they're doing and why, and start to think about why they're doing it. It doesn't make sense, you know, and use that to be, to brew your own deck as well. Everyone has the dream of brewing their own homebrew that nobody's ever thought about and spiking a GP with it. Yeah. But I think those days are long over.
So everyone's journey through Magic is unique. We all have highs and lows, but those highs and lows are different for every single person. So we would love to dive into two experiences with you. The first one being your worst Magic moment. And what did you learn from that experience?
I'd probably say that's a tough one. Worst Magic moment. I think one of the moments that made me feel the worst was I was playing in, well, I guess there's two moments that made me feel really bad. One, I was playing my very first Legacy GP ever, and I was playing Affinity because it's all I had left. And it was actually like the old school standard Affinity deck with Disciple of the Vaults and stuff. And my friend, who's a avid Legacy player, was like, that deck's terrible. Like, what are you doing? You know, this is back when people were playing Energy Flux in Legacy, which is for people that don't know, is an enchantment that makes all your artifacts cost 2 every upkeep, or you have to sacrifice them. So, yeah, it's not something you want to play against when you're playing a deck full of artifacts. So I was like, well, it's all I have. I'll try it out. And my round one opponent goes turn 2 Kitaki War's Wage, which makes you pay 1 for your artifacts every upkeep or you sacrifice them. And I was like, are you kidding me? And he goes, yeah, I only really play at my local events with my friends, and they all love Affinity. I was like, nobody was playing Affinity at the time. I was like, oh, geez, this sucks. So that was a pretty feel-bad moment from a on a luck standpoint, and then from a rules lawyering standpoint, I had a GP that I played at, and I was playing blue white again. It was Legacy. I was playing blue white Stoneblade, and in I think it was like round three or four, I forget what it was. I had a opponent cast a show and tell. And again, this was maybe my third or fourth Legacy event. And I didn't know what show and tell did. So I just asked him, I said, what does show and tell do? And he goes, we each put a permanent into play. I said, okay, which is not what it does, by the way. It's each player puts a artifact, creature, enchantment, or one other permanent type, maybe land or something, into play. And I put Jace the Mind Sculptor into play. And he put a Progenitus into play. And then he called a judge immediately and got really angry with me, like I was trying to cheat him or something, which I took a big offense to. And I called the judge, and he was like, I told him we each put something into play, and he put Jace into play. And I was like, well, you told me we each put a permanent into play. I mean, I didn't read the card. I just did what you told me it did. And so the judge was like, okay, well, we're going to re-resolve this show and tell, which now I felt bad about because I knew he was putting Progenitus into play. But it's what the judge ruled, so I picked my Jace back up, and the guy was really mad, and he put his Progenitus back down, and I put Batterskull into play, and then on his end step, flashed in a Vendilion Click and equipped Batterskull and raced him. And I probably would have put the Vendilion Click into play if I didn't know he was putting Progenitus into play, and then not been able to cast the Batterskull the next turn. So I felt really bad that situation resulted in me ending up with a game win that I shouldn't have had. It was unfortunate that it was a communication error on his part, but I also felt bad that he made me feel like I was a cheater when I asked him what the card did. And for anybody that knows anything about Magic, you know, the era of cheating and getting away with it is long gone. Back in the early 90s, pros cheated all the time, and because it was easy to get away with it. And you just don't do it. You know, you're going to get caught. It's not worth it. Ask anybody that's been banned for cheating. It's stupid. And what do you win? You know, at best, you add like 5%, 10% points to your win rate. Maybe it gets you into a top 8 of one GP. Guess what? Then you get banned. Is that worth it? No. So that's probably the worst, is getting called a cheater when you're not doing anything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really – yeah, I mean – you're definitely not alone. Like, a lot of people don't take kindly to being falsely accused, because just, you know, inside you just get all riled up and be like, no, like, you know, it's the injustice of it, or the perceived injustice, or the worry of the injustice that's going to come down when you honestly didn't do anything wrong. Yeah, that gets people riled up real fast. I can definitely see how that'd be a very uncomfortable situation. But like you said, you followed through with what the judge said, and it was miscommunication on your opponent's part, but still, you know, being put in that situation is definitely no fun. And obviously, I think one obvious lesson is read the cards. You know, take it upon yourself to read your opponent's cards if you're unfamiliar with what they do or whatever. Did you learn anything else from that experience that you want to share, or do you think reading the card would have kind of solved that?
Yeah, reading the card definitely would have solved it. And actually, there's a funny top 8 video, and I should have been more careful reading the cards, but if you watch, there's a YouTube video from a Star City tournament where I'm playing Gerard Fabiano. It wasn't top 8, it was playing for a win and in for top 8. And every time he plays a land, I have to read what the land does because I'm colorblind also. So I can't just look at the like Taiga and tell what it does. I have to like pick it up and see what the mana symbols are. And so the commentators are like, oh, he really loves that black border dual land. I'm like, no, I'm just trying to see what mana it taps for.
He really loves that black border dual land. That's funny. Yeah. That's really funny.
So yeah, reading cards is important.
So I guess the symbology or the iconography of Magic really helps you then, huh? Being colorblind.
Yeah, sometimes it's still difficult because on the old cards, you know, planes and the little plane symbol and swamp symbols, kind of the detail of the cards wasn't that great, and they kind of looked similar. But it definitely helps. And then they go make artifacts that are different shades of brown and gray and stuff. So sometimes it can be a pain.
So, total divergent. Like, are you black and white colorblind, or?
No, red, blue, green. It's just a difficulty distinguishing shades of colors from one another.
Yeah.
I can see color. but like purples and blues and purples and blacks and reds and blacks can kind of blend together and look the same.
So were you equally or more frustrated with the what color is this dress thing that went around a couple of years ago on the internet? Do you remember that? Did you see that?
What color is dress?
No, what color is this dress?
It was golden and black.
Yeah, golden blue one. Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. So, did that bother you more than most?
No, okay. Not at all.
All right, I digress. So, obviously, thank you for sharing that moment and what you shared from it. The flip side are our highs and our proud moments. So, what has been your proudest Magic moment to date, Adam?
Probably my proudest moment was making my first pro tour. I thought that was really cool. You know, it's something you kind of if you really love the game of Magic, you dream about it. Like, oh man, one day I want to be on the pro tour. That'd be so cool. And especially to have my first pro tour be in Ireland, which was the first time I've been off the continent. And Ireland's beautiful. So that was fantastic. And the Guinness factory was great.
Nice. That's awesome. That's awesome. That's the story you shared with us earlier of how you basically spiked that PTQ.
Yeah, awesome. Exactly. Just random luck, walked into a tournament, built a deck out of... Tell you what, if you can win a PTQ building a deck out of someone's trade binder, then there's something to be said.
Yeah. What format was it? Was it standard?
That was standard, yeah.
So that's interesting that you gravitated to Domi Raid, because my Domi Raid story was the very first standard event I ever went to. I borrowed a friend's deck that had Domi Raid in it. And so I wasn't like super familiar with it. It was at a fair. I don't even remember what it was, but it was at some state fair or something like that. I don't know if it was just an event or if it was some kind of qualifier. I have no idea. But this was like my first time ever doing a standard event. And I distinctly remember dying to Boros Reckoner and... what's that deal? 13 damage to all creatures.
Oh, yeah. Blasphemous Act or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. And what boils my blood about that is I hate dying to combos that I don't even know exist, you know?
Yeah.
Because I'm just putzing along doing my thing, and they're like, Boros Reckoner. I'm like, okay. He might have even played another one, you know? And so I'm like, yeah, okay. And then he goes, Blasphemous Act, 13 damage to all creatures, including my guys. They trigger, dealing 26 damage to you. You're dead. And I wait, what? And yeah, so that's my Domi Raid story. My first standard event ever, borrowed a deck. My lessons learned from that, obviously, don't do that. Well, it worked well for you, but for me, practice a little bit more, be familiar with the deck, have a cursory familiarity with the other decks in the format, so you don't get blown out by combos that you have no idea exists, because that's bothersome, at least for me.
So. Yeah, I can imagine that, or like just walk into, what was it? Bonfire of the Damned or whatever format. Remember that?
Yeah. Is it the Miracle one?
What? Yeah. What, you just top decked a card that blew out my whole board? Like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. I actually really like, not Miracles the deck, but Miracles the cards. I think they're actually really fun. So anyways, that's cool. Good stuff. So how do you go about preparing for events? So let's say you have, you know, an event coming up, a Grand Prix or whatever. How far out are you doing what? Like, what does your preparation look like as the event gets closer and closer?
Well, if it's depends on the format. If it's Legacy, I'm usually always playing the same deck, so that's not hard. Like Legacy, I don't want to say it's a stale format, but there's not. I mean, the decks that are around are pretty much beaten to death by this point. You know what's going to be there. If it's something like Standard, again, because of the card pool size, there's maybe 5-6 possible decks that you're going to play against. So as long as I'll typically just practice by playing local FNMs and Monday Night Magics, and people bring their home brews and learn how to interact against certain decks so that you know, like keeping your walking ballistas against Shaheeli Rai decks so that you don't just get blown out, that kind of stuff. And then for limited, I usually use Magic Online to practice, because if you can, you know, there's a little bit of an expense to get started. You might put $30 or $40 into some booster packs, and then if you can get reasonable at limited enough to at least just kind of break even, you can play for a long time and get a lot of practice in against people that are actually pretty good online, and that'll help you get better. I also, if I'm doing something like really high value, something like a pro tour or a GP, the other way I'll practice that's limited, I'll just, if I win any packs or boxes from pre-releases or local tournaments, I'll save them up And then I'll just do kind of Rochester drafts. A lot of people don't know what that is, but it's a format that existed a long time ago that you would draft the packs face up. And then I'll do that by myself. Even sometimes I'll have a friend come over. Sometimes I'll just do it by myself. And you just pick and you say, okay, this is going to be a 4-person draft, and you pick a card. Then you hand the pack to the next person and they pick a card and you hand it to the next person. And you start to understand like how quickly certain color combinations are getting pulled from packs and what packs might look like when the high value cards have been taken out of them. And you can also, I think they've done a lot recently to mix up print runs, but they do still have noticeable common print runs. So you can just open up lots of packs and you start to pick up on the pattern of, you know, maybe a Cathartic Reunion 75% of the time is right next to like a disenchant style effect or something. So then you open up a pack and there's the disenchant style effect. Pretty good chance that the guy next to you took the Cathartic Reunion, kind of a thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's real ninja right there. And like you said, it's not like 100% accurate, but you are absolutely right. I've done drafts where you see commons that are, you know, packed together, sometimes, you know, 2-3 of the same card in a row in different packs. And so that's a really good observation. Like, hey, there's a good chance that they might have took this, which could cue you into, you know, what color they're on. That's
right.
That's smart.
And it used to be really bad. Like it used to be maybe there was, you know, 8 to 12 common print runs, and it was pretty easy to tell what the people around you were picking. And Wizards has done a good job of mixing things up since then, so it's a little less prevalent, but there's definitely still 3 to 4 card runs that you can discover.
You know, it's so funny. This is the second episode in a row that we've mentioned Rochester Draft. Like we go 180.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 180 whatever episodes without ever mentioning it, probably once or maybe once. I don't know. It's been a long time. And then just last episode, we had Jerry Thompson on and he mentioned, you know, Rochester Draft back in the day. So we kind of, you know, did a brief synopsis of what it was. And then here you are mentioning it again. So just in case you're new to the show, Prodigies, Rochester Draft back in the day, you would actually lay out your booster pack, face up, and everybody could see the cards. And the first person would pick one card out of the pack. Again, face up so everybody could see it. And then the next person would make their pick and so forth and so on. So you could see what every single person was drafting. And it added a whole nother layer of complexity and skill, skill level to it, because now you know that the person next to you is in green and the next guy after that's in blue. And then they all know that you're in red, but then somebody else could try and cut you off from red. And so it just added a whole nother layer of complexity, like I said. And that's how draft used to be. It used to be Rochester draft all face up. And, it was very time consuming. And so they kind of, went to the new style that we have now, and to kind of save on time. That's not the only reason, but that's one of the reasons why. But yeah, roster draft, old school format.
But that's a good way to get really good at drafting. Is you get to see, one, it's really hard because you're knowing what you're getting cut off of, but you get to start to develop the ability to remember what other people have, so that when you get paired against them, you know what threats you need to play around, which is good when you're just playing normal standard and you lose game one. And now if you can remember what they played against you, you know what to do differently in game two or game three. But also just to see how 7 other people are thinking and how they're making their picks and why they're picking things the way that they are might lead you to say, hey, you know, that's a good idea. Maybe I should try that next time.
Super awesome. Love it. Absolutely love it. So as you've played Magic for years and years and years and just, you know, been exposed to a wide variety of opponents, what has been the biggest mistake that you see players make?
I would probably say rushing. I think a lot of players, maybe more so at a like a local level than at a major tournament level, but I notice local FNMs and stuff, people just do things very quickly and then they don't think about the consequences of what they're doing or the risks involved with making the decision that they're making. And an example would be, if you're playing against a control deck and they have 5 open mana and you draw your card and you have a creature in play, and the first thing you do is you cast your spell, because you're just eager to cast that spell in your hand you really want to cast. Well, now you just gave your control opponent great options. They can go, is it worth countering the spell or killing your creature when it attacks me? Versus attacking first, getting the damage in, making them make the decision right there. Do I want to tap out to kill this thing, or do I want to save it for a counterspell? And making hasty decisions can end up, it's little things that cost you games, or it used to be. Now it seems to be every card's a haymaker, but it used to be lots of little decisions added up to whether or not you won the match against your opponent. And that's why you saw the same, you know, 50 pros winning everything all the time. And now it's just like, oh, I top decked, you know, my Avacyn, deal with it. So
yeah, interesting. Very interesting. So how do we get better at that? How do we avoid that mistake?
Just take your time, you know, think about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and make sure it makes sense to you. And, you know, there's no, you get a reasonable amount of, even at big tournaments, you know, you're not going to get called for slow play for taking 10 seconds to think about what you're going to do. You know, don't make it 2 minutes. That's a little unreasonable, but you just make sure, you know, people tend to only, my experience of watching people is they only tend to take time making a decision when it involves combat math. And that's one small portion of a turn. So, you know, the most important decision, obviously, is whether or not to keep your opening hand. People see one land, they throw it away. Well, maybe that one lander was really good, especially if you're on the draw and you have a 75% chance of drawing a second land by turn three. You know, maybe you should have kept it, especially if your hand's all two drops, you know. So I think just taking your time, making sure that you're comfortable and you're happy with your decision, that could go a long way in helping to improve your game.
Love it. That's really good. That's good stuff right there. Now, what have you learned from Magic that you've been able to apply to other areas of your life?
Not really sure how I could answer that. I'd like to say I learned things such as like math and quick calculations, but I've always naturally been pretty gifted when it comes to math and making quick decisions on the fly. Mathematically,
it definitely sounds like the electrical engineer talking.
yeah, that is. Yeah. And that actually is very valuable, you know, being able to say I have an 80% shot of getting this outcome based on the number of cards left in your deck.
And yeah, I love that. And I would love to be better at that for sure. Like, yeah, for me, I would have to like just memorize, you know, charts, be like, okay, but that's how I would have to do it. But that's, I mean, I love being able to run through that process and be like, oh, like I have a 70% chance of drawing what I need in the next two draws. So I think that's just so cool. I've always been fascinated with people who can rattle that off.
And actually my buddy Bryant, he's the Storm player I was talking about earlier. I don't know if he could do the math very quickly in his head to come up with a statistical percentage, but he's actually just put in the work to memorize all of the statistical chances he has of winning based on his Storm deck. You know, like my opponent has a 40% chance of having a Force of Will, and they have a 32% chance of having a Force of Will and a blue card. He just memorizes those things so that he can make good decisions on the fly. But it's hard for me to think of things that I learned in Magic and took away from it. Definitely, I got friendships out of it. So that's awesome. Great. People I met that I wouldn't have otherwise ever met. And most Magic players tend to be pretty friendly people that are also tend to be usually pretty good people too, you know, especially at the casual level. You know, people come into pre-releases, they're just looking to kick back, have fun, have some laughs, and see some cool stuff happen. Those are the types of people that are fun to hang out with.
Totally agree. And turning the lens inward on you, what's the deepest thing you've learned about yourself through your journey through Magic?
Well, I learned that in certain situations I can have a short temper, but I think that happens. You know, you get frustrated at your, I think the thing I've probably learned is that I can get frustrated at my inability to control an outcome. You know, you ever get those, the best thing I can explain it with is I was playing in the top eight of a PTQ, and I was playing a black white devotion during the Theros block with the pack rats, and I had splashed red for Blood Baron of Viscopa, and that was a metagame call because the meta was so stale on mono black devotion that I was like, okay, I gotta play, or no, it was just black white, I think, but I gotta play Blood Baron of Viscopa. In the top eight, I kept an opener with two Underworld Connections, which was like an enchantment that drew you extra cards. I think I have the name right, maybe I have the name wrong, and five lands. And I ended the game with 17 lands and two Underworld Connections. And I was just extremely frustrated at you know, like what the probability of the top 12 cards of my library being lands is astronomically low.
Yes.
And I was like, I was just, I got so frustrated. And then I wasn't being mean, but I was just being like snotty to my opponent. And then afterward, I was just like, man, I shouldn't have acted that way. That was unreal. It's not his fault, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, you start to learn, like, you know, that's something I could improve on in myself, is being able to better handle negative outcomes when I don't have control over them.
Yeah, very interesting. Wow. So as we pull into the home stretch here, how many pro points do you have this season?
Oh, gee, I don't think a lot. Maybe like 8 or 9. I don't even know how many I got for the GP top 8. I think I only got 4 or 5 from that. So not a lot, less than 10.
Less than 10. Okay. So, I mean, because we love watching, you know, past guests go on and do great things. And so we want to know, you know, where are you going to be? What events are you going to? And do you have a chance, to make silver, for example? Are you going to make a run for it? We know that you're going to go to the Pro Tour coming up, so you get 3 points just for that. But do you have any other events coming up?
Well, I'll probably go. I think the Saturday is another local qualifier for the regional PTQ. So since it's local, I'll probably go play that one.
Cool.
My new rule of thumb is just if it's like more than an hour away, I'm just not even going to go to them. It's not worth it, in my opinion. But I'll probably go to that and play in that. And then I think GP, whichever one's up in Canada, that's coming up here soon. Can't think of the name. Not Toronto, but the constructed GP.
Yeah, for that one.
Yeah,
I have it on my calendar, but I can't think of the name. Yeah,
but we're gonna play. I'm gonna play in that, and I'll probably go to GP Vegas.
Oh, excellent!
That seems like it's gonna be a lot of fun.
Excellent.
And then hopefully I'll do well enough at this Pro Tour Nashville to end up in Japan. And I would be dreading that. I don't speak any Japanese, but it would be an interesting experience.
You'll be with a bunch of English speaking Magic players. You'll be fine.
Right. Yeah. Well, the last time I worked hard for it, I missed silver by just a couple of points. And that was pretty depressing. But now I don't really have the time or the energy to strive hard for silver. So if it happens, that'd be great. If it doesn't, that's okay with me too. More just about having fun and enjoying the game, and we'll see where luck takes me.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Quick reminder to the Prodigies out there. The best place to connect with Adam is we're going to get him into the Prodigy Facebook group. So if you haven't yet, go ahead and request to join there. We'll get him in there, and you can say thank you or ask him a follow-on question. But yeah, that would be the best way to find him because he is not on the Twitter. So Adam, what is one last parting piece of guidance? Either something you've already said that you want to emphasize or something new that you want to leave with us here at the end?
Well, I would just say, you know, have fun. At the end of the day, it's a game, right? So if you can't – I lost the top 8 of a GP. And I was smiling. So if you can't have fun and enjoy what you're doing, then there's no point in doing it. So that'd be my advice.
Well, Adam, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your time with us today. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it has been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious. Adam, thank you again for being on the show. Loved having you here. What an excellent interview. Prodigies, I really hope that you learned something because I know I did. Of course, you can find these show notes at mtgprotutor.com/AdamVanFleet. So just look them up there for a synopsis of what we talked about, as well as links to any resources that were mentioned. If you are not a member of the Prodigy Facebook group yet, why not? Come on in. Look up MTG Pro Tutor on Facebook. You'll probably find a page and then a group. Feel free to follow the page if you like, and then also request to join the group. We love having new faces in the Prodigy group. We love helping people grow. No question is too dumb. I started the group on the premise that I hated it when I would see people ask, hey, what's the best card for this deck? And the answer was, that deck sucks. You should be playing something else. I hate that, right? So we formed a community with high standards and high values where anybody can ask any question, doesn't matter how hard or easy, and you will get respectful, uplifting answers. People who really want to help you with your deck and who are honest seekers of improvement all dwell in the Prodigy Facebook group. So come join us there, mtgprotutor.com/Facebook group, and I look forward to interacting with you there. Thanks again for joining me today. I can't wait to connect again real soon. Make sure you subscribe to the show so you don't miss a beat. And until next time, I'm Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery, be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.